Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie. There are over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Thanks so much. Hello and welcome back to the Book Versus Movie podcast. I am your host, Margot D, and I normally co-host the show with the illustrious Margot P. But these are special Stephen King bonus eps, and that's when we bring on our friends who are fellow podcasters and also Stephen King geeks. And it also gives Margot a break while she's finishing her first book. Congratulations to Margot. We will be talking about it in the show soon. Today's special guest is Adam Riske. He is with the podcast F This Movie, and he's also a contributor to their site, fthismovie.net. Adam is one of the funniest people I know, so when you're listening to me in this podcast, I basically turn into a total gigglepuss. He's just that hilarious. But we have a really great time talking about two different Stephen King productions. One is the 1992 movie Sleepwalkers, which was directed by Mick Garris, an old friend of Stephen King's. And it's based on an original screenplay by King, but not a short story or novella or anything like that. It's not adapted from anything except the screenplay. Then I talk about Sometimes They Come Back. Now, that was a short story that was featured in Night Shift. And the TV movie we're talking about today came out in 1991 on CBS TV, and it stars Tim Matheson. And for you listeners of Book Versus Movie, just to let you know, there are plenty of Stephen King properties in Audible. Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to check out their service. Just go to audibletrial.com/book-versus-movie to check them out. In addition to everything, Adam and I also talk about the upcoming Pet Sematary remake, what we think about it. We talk about a very special episode of The Cosby Show we both happen to like, RIP to the syndication there. We talk about the HBO dramedy Dream On and the singer Jane Child. She comes up in here. And I should warn you guys, we not only do we spoil both movies here, but we use plenty of salty language. So just to keep that in mind if there are kiddies in the room. Okay, everyone, so here we go with our Stephen King bonus ep today. We're talking about Sleepwalkers, and Sometimes They Come Back with Adam Riske from F This Movie. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Margot.
I'm really excited that we're doing this. We talked about this months and months ago, so I'm glad we're finally getting this in our schedules. You're a very busy guy. You're going to meet Coolio this weekend as we are talking.
I sure am, yeah. It's been amazing, but I could finally ask him what the energy was acting opposite Michelle Pfeiffer in the Gangsta's Paradise music video. Like, can you imagine, like, she sits down and she's just like, are you going to tell me what I want to know? And then he's probably like all nervous. And then he's like, oh, I thought I was just going to do the song.
I told you he was really pissed at Al Yankovic for his version, his satire of it. And I just loved it with Florence Henderson in the Amish gear, straddling the chair.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure the joke will be on me on Sunday, though, and he'll be, like, the nicest person.
Oh, right, and you're going to feel like an asshole.
Yeah, that's usually how it goes.
So let me ask you, so are you a big Stephen King fan? Are you a dabbler? Like, what's your experience with Stephen King?
Yeah, I am a big Stephen King fan, but most of my Stephen King knowledge is movie-based. I'm just seeing, like, adaptations of his work. Over the years, he was really instrumental to the horror movies that I grew up on as sleepover movies and my gateways to becoming a bigger fan of the genre when I was a preteen and a teenager. So a lot of my first experiences with it were things like Pet Sematary at too young of an age and being like really freaked out by the guy with half his brain hanging out of his head and Aunt Zelda. And also The Shining was something that my parents showed my sister and I at a really young age. We were like 9 or so.
Oh my God.
I had just started seeing R-rated movies. I remember just begging to go see Terminator 2 in the theaters. And then after that, it was basically like, well, he's seen Terminator 2. He can see anything. So so we rented The Shining from Blockbuster, and it was like a night during the winter on a Saturday night, and I watched it, and I remember being like not that traumatized by it, except for the very ending, with spoilers for The Shining, the zoom into the shot of Jack in the hotel, because I just couldn't reconcile what that meant, because everything I think up only had like kind of a single meaning. So I'm just like, well, what is it? I know this, like, what is happening? So it was like I needed some kind of a like a psycho monologue at the end. I never got it. So Stephen King's always been a fixture of my fandom for the horror genre. In terms of his books, I feel like a fraud being on your show a little bit, because I'm not a big reader when it comes to novels. I tend to read a lot more nonfiction and things like that. So I don't know if I've ever read a Stephen King novel.
Here, I don't care if you read at all. It's a read-free zone as far as I'm concerned. You can just enjoy his movies. You can just enjoy his interviews. I mean, honestly, or just his Twitter feed. I'm totally okay with that. So I think that's awesome. I was the same way, but for me, I'm a little bit older than you. And it was Salem's Lot on TV. And it was the original one with David Soul and Lance Kerwin. And my siblings, we were very young, and mom was just, we were moving. And so the house was empty, and we just had boxes everywhere. And it was on TV that night. And mom's like, all right, we'll get some pizza and we'll watch this thing. And it scared the living shit out of us. But I loved it. I realized I loved being scared. And so I tell people I went from Judy Blume right into Stephen King books. Like, I made a fast detour, either the fourth or fifth grade. And I kind of like never looked back.
Yeah, I think I went from like scary stories to Tell Into the Dark right to Stephen King. And it was like all within a matter of about a week and a half.
Or it feels like that anyway, right?
yeah, definitely.
Okay. So you and I, we picked two different things, I think very different things here. Why don't you go first? You really wanted to talk about this. I finally saw this. I have not seen this movie probably since 1992. Will you talk about it now, Sleepwalkers?
I would love to. Sleepwalkers is a perfect movie, so I'll just set that up. feel free to disagree. In my estimation, it's a perfect movie. Sleepwalkers tells the story of a tribe of nomadic, shape-shifting energy vampires that are also cat people, sort of, but they're based off of vampire lore, and they're the Brady family. It's a mother and son. Charles and I'm blanking on the mother's name. She is
Mary
Brady. And so in coastal California to Indiana at the beginning of the movie. And the reason why they're doing that is because they stay in one spot. They find a virgin to remove the soul through their mouth from, and they retain youth and energy from that. And then they have to go because then the heat is on them. So they have to find a new place to stay because I guess this energy is only a temporary fix, and they kind of have to feed it like a vampire needs blood in order to survive. So at the beginning of the movie, the Bradys go to Indiana. They kind of seek out who they find to be the most intriguing candidate for their kind of web of nonsense, and who they find is this girl Tanya, who is kind of a merit scholar, girl next door type, and throughout the movie the first kind of third is Charles wooing Tanya, and it's very like 1950s-esque, like traditional kind of courting, and it's a very Stephen King small town atmosphere. And then as the movie progresses, you kind of see that all is not what it appears to be. You already know that kind of with the Bradys, but the other characters in the movie catch on pretty quickly that this pair isn't kind of the typical mother-daughter that you would expect them to be. First of all, they're They're incestuous. They can rip off your hand. They can morph their faces into cats. So that's sort of kind of the thread of the story. And then a lot of interesting characters, supporting wise, kind of weave their way in and out, whether it's police officers or teachers, or just kind of what I read was the Robert De Niro of cat actors. This cat Clovis, who kind of fits into the story in a pivotal way in the second and third acts.
That cat is amazing, by the way, Clovis.
Yeah, I didn't realize until this time out how integral Clovis was to the plot of the third act. I thought it was kind of more of like a comic relief thing, and I'm like, no, the comic relief is the engine to get Clovis to become the hero.
So this is a Mick Garris movie, and
Yes. He's
directed a few Stephen King properties. The Stand comes to mind for me. And did he also do The Langoliers?
No, he did the Stand. He did The Shining with Stephen Weber and Rebecca De Mornay.
Oh, yes.
He did Riding the Bullet, Desperation, and Bag of Bones.
He's done quite a few Stephen King properties, and he's like a good friend of Stephen King's, and he loves, and he also in this movie he has John Landis and Joe Dante in supporting roles.
Yeah. This was from what I read, this was one of the first horror movies that had a lot of cameos. This was kind of before this was more of a thing, and Joe Dante pops up, John Landis, Clive Barker. Toby Hooper, and who am I for? Stephen King himself, and then Mark Hamill at the beginning too.
I was just going to say Mark Hamill's, and I thought, wow, they got a Mark Hamill type to like be in this movie, and I had to like look at the credits, and I couldn't believe it was him. So, what did you think of the performances here? Madgen Amick. How do you say her name? Madgen as Tanya. What do you think of her?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to start with Madgen Amick because let me tell you, Margo, I don't mean to. I'm like, you know, a guy about Madgen Amick, and I know I already kind of got you worried, but I'll pick this up quickly. When I was 10, when I saw this movie, I was like, I don't know who I'm going to marry, but I want her to be like that one.
Well, she's beautiful.
Well, she's just like so just charming girl next door type. That's always just been who I've been drawn to. Mm-hmm. And I think she's really charming and likable, and like you said, beautiful movie. I have a little bit of trouble with how her character throughout the plot of the movie, not a lot, but she's almost too good at acting some of the stuff where you just feel bad after a while, where it's like you can't, where it's just like, oh, I'm just watching a movie. It's like, seems like she's in genuine pain and trauma. Did you get any of that, or is it just...
Yeah, I'm a little older than you. So she was in a show called Twin Peaks, and that was just out like 2 or 3 years before. And she was really, really good on that show. And she was also surrounded by really good actors and a really interesting script and a really good director. So this is not the case for her here. She's around. What am I saying? They are good actors. I think Alice Krieg is really interesting as the mother. I think she's also like really beautiful and otherworldly. I think you're right though. I think like she's acting at a level that I think everybody else is sort of like, you know, this is kind of a goof, and she's like taking it seriously.
Alice Krieg, I've seen her in another story, which was a horror movie from the early 80s. And she was the Borg queen in Star Trek First Contact. And she was one of the villains in Silent Hill. And she's got the same kind of energy in every movie where, like, you're not sure if this is just what this woman is really like in real life. Or
right.
If you're just, like, or she's just, like, a great method-type actress. But, like, she's phenomenal in this movie. Like, there's no hint of this is a person acting. Like, this is just this woman. I think she's really terrific. Brian Krause, I think, is... sometimes really good, and sometimes I don't know. I think, like you said, it has to do maybe a little bit with the tone and maybe with how he's directed, because especially in that turn in the middle of the movie where he's revealed to be a sleepwalker, it basically turns on a dime from him going from playing charming, which I think he's really, to playing like comical evil, which I don't think that he's as good at.
No, it is. And he turns on a dime. Like he takes her out on a date, and then does he take her to a graveyard? I mean, is that where they have this date? But
can we break? I wrote this down because I wanted to talk about this. Can we break down this date for a moment? Because
what is going on here?
So they go to a cemetery so she can take pictures. Well, it's a picnic cemetery date, which who hasn't had one of those? He's there to do chalk drawings, and she's there to take photography, photography.
And by the way, when he first meets her, I have to go back to this. She works at a movie theater, and we meet her. She has her Walkman, and she's listening to that song, Do You Love Me?, which is that 50s song, like that's from Dirty Dancing. Mm-hmm. They play constantly. And she's like dancing around and vacuuming. You're like, oh, the place is closed. So that's what she's doing to amuse herself. And then he just walks over and he goes, hey, can I have some popcorn? I'm like, wait a minute, they're open? Like, people are there, like, and you're just dancing around to this song?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
I worked at a movie theater for 2 days in my lifetime, and I didn't have time to dance at all.
2 days?
It is one of my favorite tropes in movies, though, that whenever they show... like an old-fashioned kind of single auditorium theater, like a classic movie palace, they always have no customers, and they are always playing like a double feature of horror classics or sci-fi movies.
It's just like he meets her, and it's like she's too good to be true. I mean, she's like, she's single, she's available, she's totally open, and he's a good-looking dude. Like, don't get me wrong, but
yeah.
And then her parents, it's almost distracting because those are the same parents that are in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and they were married in real life.
Yeah, I didn't know that they were married. Yeah, exactly. I didn't know that they were married in real life either. And then I heard that they got divorced like 6 years later, and I feel like that's not fair. Like,
no, it's a bummer, right?
Yeah.
We should talk to them.
I don't get it either. What was I going to say about Brian Cranston? Oh, on the, so our timing to do this Sleepwalkers discussion is really good because Scream Factory, which is a horror movie kind of genre boutique, just came out with the collector's edition of Sleepwalkers. So I was watching some behind the scenes stuff. They do like a lot of retrospective kind of interviews and things like that. So they had an interview with Brian Krause and Matt Shinamick. Apparently when this movie came out on its opening day, Brian Krause was in jail because he didn't pay like a lot of overdue parking tickets or like kind of traffic violations. So he was in jail for 45 days. So apparently one of his cellmates or one of the people kind of in his prison block had a copy of the newspaper, and it was a picture of Brian Krause and Alice Krieg and Matt Shinamick from Sleepwalkers. It was like a publicity still. And he says to Brian Krause, he goes, is this you? And then Brian Krause goes, yeah. And he goes, give me your lunch tomorrow and I won't tell anybody.
All right. One thing. I'm calling bullshit on that story. He was not in there for 45 days over parking tickets. Let's just say that. Let's just make that clear. Mr. Krause.
You said hot fire.
Yes. Come at me, Mr. Krause. But that's a great story. Ron Perlman's in here too, by the way. I didn't recognize him at first.
Yeah, this was post Beauty and the Beast, but before he kind of had a big movie career.
I found this movie, and all the cats. How the hell did they herd all those cats? There's cats everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess once you hire the Robert De Niro of cat actors, then all the other well-known cat actors are like, I've always wanted to work with him. His name was Sparks. Clovis was played by Sparks the cat.
I think he's a Russian blue. He's a very cute cat.
Yeah. I'm more of a dog person, but like when I see, you know, Sparks, I'm just like, I get it. You know.
When you see one of the good ones.
Yeah. I got a question for you. On your show, do you do spoilers much, or should I
absolutely
walk around those a little bit?
Nope, okay. Spoil away.
Okay. So there's a lot of things that I love about this movie. A lot of it has to do with nostalgia. A lot of it is just I find it to be relentlessly entertaining, and it's so weird. And like movies nowadays aren't very weird, which is
right.
A bummer, because I mean, like, I think like the way that the movie is kind of the story is told is odd. And then just sort of like the fact that you've got like, you know, the beginning of the third act is this Catman, like basically having like a food poisoning episode almost, like on a couch. And then they're just like, hey, can you make yourself disappear? And he's just like, oh, I'll try. It's like, I don't know. You don't get that in Venom or anything like that anymore.
You don't get incest very often either.
No, Venom would have been much better with incest, let me tell you. Instead, it just had 20 minutes of end credits. Did you know that it has 20 minutes of end credits?
I've never seen Venom.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
You shouldn't. It's really, really bad. But one thing I noticed, too, in this viewing of Sleepwalkers is, and it's something that we'll get into with the other movie we're talking about, there are certain things in Stephen King's stories that I just drive me nuts, which is, I'll use the Sleepwalkers example first. So at the end of the movie, Tanya is, you know, the Bradys are dead, Tanya is safe, and then Clovis jumps in the police cruiser, Tanya picks up Clovis, and she goes, it's just you and me now, Clovis. It's just you and me, or something like that. And she hugs Clovis. If you were her, wouldn't you be like, oh, my God, my parents?
Yeah. Hi, I'm an orphan now. Or are they okay? Are they in the hospital? Are the parents are okay? I feel like they were hurt, but they weren't killed. So we're meant to think that's okay. But I think Tanya, I think she grows up in this movie, and she becomes her own person, and she realizes that she can handle cat demons. And with her trusty Russian blue by her side, she's going to be okay.
Can you imagine her, like, college entry essay? She probably has to delete the old one. And she's like, I got a much better overcoming obstacle story.
Oh, my God. Well, so what did you think of the special effects of this movie? I'm laughing as they say that.
The special effects are kind of okay. Like, it depends on which effect it is. The cat people suits are silly.
Yeah.
The cat they even say like on the Blu-ray that they ran out of time to make the cat heads look like proportionate with the cat bodies. Because they didn't have time to kind of figure out like how to make the head so it looks not ridiculous, but also like has all the mechanical outputs that they would need to have in there. So that's a little bit wonky. The face morphing that happens during like the high speed chase, I think is pretty great.
Yeah.
Especially for 1992.
Yeah.
Although when I see that, and I think it's just because there's a passing resemblance, I can't not think of Paul Walker's digital composite in Furious 7 at the end.
Oh my God, yes.
So I think what I'm trying to say is, they screwed up Fast and Furious 8, so they need to get Brian Krause to come and play Brian O'Connor. And just pretend like nothing happened. Like, don't explain it. Just pretend like nothing happened. Just slide it in. One question for you. All right. The Bradys, they kill one person, like, for their soul, and then they move to a new town. If you were in a similar situation, you, like, decorate as much.
Did they just get there? Did they just arrive there? And then is that one of their powers too? Like they can just point to a catalog and like, we want the room to look like this. And then all of a sudden, like it's all like completely decked out. That could be one of their magic powers.
Yeah. I mean, like, did they like invade somebody's house and like take it over? Or did they like take the time to really build it from the ground up like a TLC show? Or an HGTV show. But, I mean, we have to talk about Deputy Andy, who is maybe one of the greatest supporting characters in a movie ever.
I got so upset for him when he was killed.
Yeah, that was a tough loss.
But I loved him with Clovis.
I remember that one kind of shaking me up when I was a kid. Like, it was, I would always get, like, this weird attachment to supporting characters in movies.
Right.
And I would get really upset if, like, certain ones died where I didn't know, like, what the trope was. So, like, I remember in Backdraft when, like, the young kid gets burned, and I'm like, but he was so excited about being a fireman. And, like, it's the same thing with Sheriff Andy. I'm just, like, he was the great cop in that town, and cat who loved him and stuff, and he had it made in the shade, and then, like, it just didn't work out. But I don't know. But I'm talking a lot about Sleepwalkers. What did you think? Because especially since this is your first revisit in 26 years.
I thought the acting was good. I mean, given the material, I think Mick Garris, not the most subtle director. I think some of the special effects were better than others. But I found it a very compelling story. And I think, honestly, I think Alice Krieg is, like, the best part of it. I mean, she plays a huge weirdo and a very bad person,
yeah.
But I found her intriguing.
Yeah, she's got like a important energy that she brings to the movie. It's almost like it grounds it because it could go real, real campy.
Right.
But yeah, it's good. I like it. I mean, like, especially with, like, genre pieces, you need, like, really strong villains, and she's a memorable one. She's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish Stephen King had written a novel or a short story around it.
Yeah, I don't know what happened with that. I mean, like, I read that he wrote this time that he wrote a screenplay that was intended to be on screen before it was a book. And yeah, I guess it just never got published, the work that he did. He just left it at the screenplay stage. But it's fun. It's maybe not having it be kind of a more fleshed out novel or story made him kind of, like, pare it down just to the most kind of pulpy elements, because it just feels like a movie that's not in a bad way, but it feels like it's in a hurry to kind of, like, deliver what a Friday night opening weekend would expect in this type of movie.
You know, the thing with the King movies is that, like, they go just way up and down in quality. And it's very hard to think nowadays when they will spend $100 million on, you know, a Stephen King property. You know, back in the day, they would just kind of throw a couple million at it, and he was grateful. He was okay. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just funny how over time they like with the It movies, they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on those things now. And it's so funny to think, like, back in the day, it was a movie of the week, and they just kind of throw it out there.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. I mean, like, it's nice that, I mean, I don't think that we would get, you know, the it in kind of the justice that it was given in, like, the recent movie if it wasn't for all these cheap, like, Stephen King movies in the, you know, 70s, 80s, and 90s, just, like,
right,
turning massive profits. So, like, people just kept going back to the well, and then, like, commissioning Stephen King to be like, hey, let's, you know, make Sleepwalkers. Like, just, it does, because I feel like this is the type of movie where he had free reign to make whatever he wanted, because if this was something where they're like, let's try to find something as commercial as possible, he probably wouldn't have turned this in.
Yeah, I was going to ask you something, and I just totally forgot. Oh, what, Pet Sematary?
Are you? Sorry.
No, I do that sometimes. No, Pet Sematary, are you interested in the remake?
No.
Oh.
I'm a remake movie, because I think that the 1989 Mary Lambert one is so indelible kind of in my brain that I can't help but think the new one's not going to measure up. And I would rather go back to the novel and kind of see it through my own eyes rather than kind of a glossy, you know, mid-budget studio movie right now. I don't know. I think, like, with It, I didn't have that problem because the TV movie is, I think, half of a good movie. So I felt like there was room to improve that. Whereas with Pet Sematary, I mean, for lack of, it's a weird movie because it's not, it's not as good as like The Shining or Carrie or Shawshank Redemption or anything like that, but it is, it's got atmosphere all day long, and it is scarier than almost, you know, with the exception of maybe like 10 other horror movies, there's nothing scarier than that, which is, you know, no easy feat when it comes to a movie like that. So I don't know. I see the children with like the masks and the drums walking through the woods, I'm just like, I don't have time for this. I know I'm going to see it, but like, I don't know. It just doesn't like interest me that much. What about you?
I think that I do like the movie very much too. I have a lot of fondness for it. I think the book is one of the scariest ones he wrote. It is a terrifying subject, and he lived in a house where they had this road that all these truckers would go really, really fast, you know, just zoom past it. And it's based on his daughter's cat was killed by one of those trucks, and then he had to, you know, explain to her, and then he said like a day or two later his son almost ran into the street and was almost hit by a truck. And so can you imagine? And so it was based on real fears for him, and when you read it you get terrified, and I think it's one of his better stories. So I'm actually really interested with better special effects, because I agree with you, but I just feel like the sister character, it scared me when I was a kid. As an adult, I see that's a dude in bad makeup. And and the little boy isn't as scary as he could be. In the book, he's fucking terrifying when he comes back.
Okay. Yeah, I think that they hired the... I don't remember their names. I think it's Wittemeyer. I'd have to go look it up. But
no, yeah, don't have to look it up.
The director for the new remake... directed this movie called Starry Eyes, and that is pure nightmare fuel. It is terrifying. So I think they got the right people.
Right.
So I'm optimistic from that regard. But a few years ago, there's this horror convention in Chicago called Flashback Weekend that I go to with Patrick Bromley, also from F This Movie. We go all the time. And this is... I don't know, it must have been like 10 years ago, but they had a reunion for Pet Sematary. And the weird thing is, this convention, by convention standards, is kind of more of a smaller, intimate one. It's in a smaller hotel, so you tend to find these celebrities who are there to sign autographs also at the restaurants and bars in the hotel during the weekend. And I was at the bar, and the guy who played, is it Pascal? Is that the character's name?
Yes.
With the gunshot wound on the head? Yeah, so he was at the bar, and he was, like, two people away from me, and I basically, like, couldn't drink my beer. I was like, are you still in purgatory? Like, the fact that he was doing something normal was almost creepier to me than he was, like, his character from the movie. So.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. But, I don't know. Sleepwalkers, man.
That was good stuff. And I have to say to you guys, both of the movies that we're talking about today, at the time that we're recording this, I'm going to release this in a few weeks, they're both available on Amazon Prime. So, for freezies, if you pay for Amazon Prime. So, okay, are you ready for my story?
I absolutely am.
Okay. So like I said, when I was a kid, I went from Judy Blume to Stephen King. And one of the first books I bought was called Night Shift. And it was this really creepy paper. It was a paperback. And then on the cover, it was a human. It was a hand. And it had all these eyes all over the palm. And it really freaked me the hell out. And it was just filled with these short stories. And this short story appeared March 1974 in Cavalier magazine. And the story I'm going to tell you about today, it's called Sometimes They Come Back. And I'm telling you, when I first read this as a kid, I'm like 10, 11 years old maybe, it scared the living shit out of me. Okay? So just picture yourself as a kid reading this. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So here we go. Sometimes They Come Back. All right. So in 1957, our protagonist is Jim Norman. And when Jim was 9 years old, he was walking with his brother Wayne. And they lived in Stratford, Connecticut. and they were walking to the library, and it was because Jim's books were overdue and they were like 4 cents or something like that. And they were walking to the library, and the thing about walking to the library is it went by this railroad overpass. And Jim was always scared because it was filled with greasers. And the greasers were real assholes. And, you know, they would call them names and they'd shake them down for money. And Jim always wanted to walk the longer way around. But his brother Wayne said, no, that's for chicken. That's for chickens. We're not chicken. We're going to walk. We're going to do it. We're going to walk that way. We're going to walk to the library. We're going to walk past the railroad. Okay. So they're going by the overpass and they are jumped by these three greasers. And the greasers start chasing them down for money. And Jim wets his pants because he's so scared. And they all stop what they're doing and they start laughing at him because he's wet his pants. And so then he's like frightened and he's scared. And his brother gets mad because they're laughing at Jim. So Wayne starts fighting back. And then one of them pulls out a switchblade and Wayne gets stabbed and Wayne is killed. And the three dudes, greasers, run away. And so Jim has to go and get help. The brother dies. And they never catch the guys who did it. Jim goes to the cops, but every kid has a parent or somebody in their life that gives them an alibi, so they get away with it. And so Jim's family, they leave Stratford, Connecticut. And so he decided for some reason, he grows up and he gets married. It's like 15, 16 years later. He's not even that much grown up. And he's married. And for some reason, well, he has a nervous breakdown. And then he decides he needs to go back to where he came from. So they move to Stratford, Connecticut. Now, they don't live in the very house he grew up in. But for some reason, it's like the only place he can get a job because somebody does him a favor. And he's a school teacher. And you should know at this time in 74, when Stephen King's writing these stories, this is just about when Carrie comes out. Stephen King was a school teacher for a while in Maine. So he really knows like how schools work and how teachers handle themselves. Okay. So Jim is a teacher and he's an English teacher and he gets the job and he's teaching all these classes and his very last class, it's called Living with Lit. And basically, it's filled with jocks and morons, like the people that, you know, it's just like basic English for people. It's the class that they send the jocks because they have to have a C average, right? And the whole thing is that there's only 27 students total in the class. And he doesn't really like it. He likes the other classes. He's kind of getting his footing. And it's weird being back in his hometown, but he's kind of okay. And he's making friends with some of the students. He likes some. He doesn't like others. And then all of a sudden, he comes back from winter break, and he finds out that one of his favorite students was killed. He was killed by, it was a hit and run. And as he's walking to class, his principal says to him, his boss, "Hey, just so you know, you have a new student today." And he's like, "Oh, no, I can't. I only have 27 students. He goes, "Well, actually, somebody died. So now you have room." It's very weird. So he looks at the folder. And the names of the killers, by the way, are Robert Lawson, David Garcia, and Vincent Corey. And he looks down, and the name is Robert Lawson. And he looks at the folder, and there's a picture of the kid. And it's Milford High School that he's transferring from. And he looks and goes, "This motherfucker looked like one of the guys that killed my brother." And he's like, "That's crazy. That can't be it." So he goes into the classroom, and it's him. And he can't prove it. I mean, how would that make any sense? You know, he hadn't aged at all in 15 years. And he has like the ducktail and the greasy hair and the leather jacket. And this is in the 70s. Kids aren't dressing like that. So he stands out. And this robber kid is just giving him a hard time. And by the way, he says that his IQ is 78 and that he's labeled as antisocial. So he's like, "Oh, great. So this is going to be fun." So Jim like recognizes him, but he doesn't say anything. And when he comes home, all of a sudden he's having bad dreams. And he's just like, "Am I going crazy? What's going on here?" And then there's another kid. Her name is Kathy Slavin. And she's like this really shy girl. All of a sudden, she dies one day. And she somehow fell off of the roof of her building. They don't know if she was shoved or she committed suicide. But guess what? There's another kid in his class now. And this kid's name is David Garcia. And he's looking at his folder, and it's another one. It's another one of the ones that killed his brother, and he knows it. And this guy's like kind of giving him a hard time, and he's thinking, holy shit. So Jim is and still doesn't tell his wife about this, by the way. And then there's so she dies, and then there's another kid that gets transferred out, and then another kid comes in, and this kid is Vincent Corey. And Vincent Corey was the one he thinks actually stabbed his brother. And Vincent Corey is basically, he takes him, sees him in his class, takes him outside the door. He's like, I know who you are. And the kid's like, yep, we're coming to get you. And he sits back there. So he's like, what the fuck do I do? So he calls the police officer that was in charge of the case when his brother was killed. And this police officer is a really nice man, used to take them out for pie and stuff like that. And says, you know what, you know, kid, I, what can I tell you? We can never get anybody to confess to it. We can never get enough evidence. I'm so sorry to hear that. And he said, well, can you help me look up these names? Because I swear to God, these kids are in my class and they all transfer from Milford High School. And then he says to him, there's no high school in Milford. There's just a cemetery. So he's like, holy shit. So he's goes home and his and he as he's home one evening, his wife is going to go out to a pottery class. And normally she walks home from the pottery class. And he says to her, you know what, tonight, can you please just take a cab? I hear there's like crazy stuff going on. There's some woman that was attacked near the school. Can you do that for me? And she says, okay, fine. Next thing you know, he gets a phone call. She was in a cab. And somebody ran the cab off the road, and she was killed. So he's like, holy shit. So he decides they're going to come to get him. They killed, you know, everybody he's cared about. So this is what he decides to do. So he goes to the classroom in the middle of the night, and he pushes all of the desks into, like, this circle. And then he draws a pentagram on the floor. And then he lights a candle in the floor and he basically starts chanting and he cuts his hand with a knife and drops the blood in the center of the pentagram. And then a voice says, what do you have to offer me? And so he takes out a pocket knife and he cuts off the index finger of his left hand and throws it into the pentagram. And then it says, I want more. So he cuts off the index finger off of his right hand and throws it in there. And then they said, what else do you have? And he goes, okay, I've got a photograph, and it's a picture of his brother. And then he says, I have a cloth with my sweat. And the thing says, sweat is precious. So he throws the cloth into the center. All of a sudden, the thugs just show up and they're like, holy shit, the guy cut off his fingers. He's got this pentagram thing going. So the thugs come in and they're coming to get him. And then all of a sudden, Wayne's spirit shows up and kidnaps the dudes and basically drags them off to hell. Like, they disappear. So they go. So then Jim is kind of cleaning up with his two mangled hands, you know, pushing the desks back and everything. And then as he's walking away, he realizes deep down, I did it this time. This time worked. But sometimes they come back. And that's the end of the story.
And interesting.
Isn't it? It fucking terrified me when I was a kid. I mean, it just had all the, like, the greasers and all that shit like that. So so it was a good story. And so 1991, CBS makes a TV movie, and it stars Tim Matheson, who was Otter in Animal House. And it has Brooke Adams as Sally, the wife, and she was in The Dead Zone. And in the movie, he has a son named Scotty. So the stakes are raised.
The son, it's this actor, Robert High Gorman, and between episodes of Boy Meets World, Leprechaun, and Rookie of the Year, I think I saw this kid as much as I saw my real friends during my youth.
And I've never heard of him.
Nah, he was such a 90s kid. It was like, it was crazy.
So the TV movie, I mean, all of the tropes are kind of there. I mean, Tim Matheson shows up and he does that very haunted. I love his 90s hair. It's kind of like Mel Gibson had in the Lethal Weapon movies, you know, flouncy.
Perfect way to
he kind of, yeah. And then you and I were talking, I think over Messenger, Facebook Messenger. So in the movie, we do have Richard Lawson, and not David Garcia. I forget the name they change it to. But in the movie, it's Vinnie Vincent, and makes me laugh because Vinnie Vincent was one of the guitarists for Kiss, like after they took off the makeup. Not very successful. And then, but he was played by a guy named Nicholas Sadler, who was known for being like a little shit in movies. Like he was always kind of a bad guy. And he was Harry in Scent of a Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was also in The Cosby Show. It's the one where Vanessa goes to a concert and she's not supposed to go. And then some guy, like, she's going to buy scalp tickets and he rips her off and he takes off with her money. Anyway, you probably
didn't. That was him?
That was him.
That was the Big Fun with the Wretched episode.
Yes!
I remember that one.
And Vanessa got in a shitload of trouble.
It was just like, yeah, she was like, no, you were about to have big fun with the Wretched.
You remember that too?
Yeah. I saw that episode a number of times, but my sister used to quote that episode quite a bit, especially the Big Fun with the Wretched line.
That's one of my favorite ones from that show. Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, too bad we can't watch it anymore.
No, you know you can. They brought them back again, kind of under the cover, but you can see those reruns again. Yeah. So this movie also features William Sanderson, and in the movie they make it four guys that killed Wayne, but one of them in the movie they stabbed Wayne to death, but that because they're by the railroad, they all got run over by a train. Like in the book, they don't really tell you how they all died. I mean, probably you just figure they're hoodlums and that's just all that happened. Oh, Dino De Laurentiis is a producer here, so that should tell you.
Yeah.
the level.
I was surprised, though. This movie, and maybe it's the Dino De Laurentiis kind of production aspect of it, it looks like a real movie. It doesn't look like a TV movie. It looks like they just so happened to film like something that was supposed to be released in theaters and it wound up on CBS.
And it did okay. I mean, there's a little bit of differences. Like they kidnap the wife and the son, but nobody dies except for the bad guys. And then in the end, like he chases them off back to hell. And then Wayne is free now, so that Wayne can then be with his parents up in heaven. And that's kind of it. And it's William Sanderson, who plays Carl, who's like the older one. And I was just, you know, hi, I'm Larry. This is my brother, Daryl. This is my other brother, Daryl. Like, that's where I know him from. Newhart.
He was, I think, in Blade Runner. I think that's where I remember him from. He was the guy who made all of the toys.
Yes.
Those weird toys, yeah.
He was good in that movie, too.
Yeah. He's solid. Did you recognize the kid who played Wayne in the movie?
No.
He was the son on that HBO show, Dream On. Do you remember that show?
Oh, my God. Brian Benben?
Yeah. That's another show I watched when I was like 9 and probably should. But I thought Terminator 2. I could handle anything.
Yeah, there was a lot of sex in that one, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Your parents were way more lax than mine.
my parents, like, they had HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, and stuff like that. And then there was a basement TV and a family room TV. And it was like, all right, well, he's downstairs watching something or playing Sega. And then, yeah, it was definitely like, I got hit pretty early on to like, oh, I can watch RoboCop for 5 minutes before they catch on. So,
right. Yeah same here.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought this movie was interesting. There's certain things in it that I'm not super crazy about because I think it's more of a success in atmosphere than it is storytelling. Like the way that you told the plot based off of the book was a lot cleaner and more interesting to me than it was in the movie, because in the movie I had a lot of, like I mentioned with Sleepwalkers, where it's like Tanya, like why is she not like worried right away, like how her parents are. This was stuff like, okay, so Wayne shows up, the hoodlums are re-killed and everything like that. Wayne is about to go back to finally going to go to heaven and everything like that. And the entire time I'm thinking, like, is Jim going to be able to go back to school the next day? Like, how weird is that going to be?
Why did they move back to the same house? It was because that was the thing, too. Like, his family lived there, and then it was abandoned. And then he just moved back again.
I don't know.
It was the only place they could get?
I'm not sure.
It spawned two sequels, by the way.
Yes. I didn't see either of them. Have you seen either of those?
No. I was looking at it. It was Sometimes They Come Back Again. And then the 1998 one is Sometimes They Come Back For Me.
Wow.
Very personal.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, it's tough because, like, you need to keep the brand name and everything. I mean, like, at least it's not, like, how they do it now, where it's like, no, it's just called Sometimes They Come Back. And it's just like, oh, you're just naming it the same thing. It's like, yeah, you know.
Yeah. It's just a few years later. So, Sometimes They Come Back. It's in the title.
Yeah. Not to go back to houses, but I got to say, like, I don't know what it is, but I mean, the house when they moved in, it's a fixer-upper. They put on some, like, I don't even know what color I would call it. What color did they paint all the walls? It's like this weird, like, orange sherbet.
Yeah, it's like pastels, right? It was.
Yeah, it looks like a room in the Caribbean beach resort. It's
like, the '90s were not great for fashion.
No, but for some reason, I think I've seen so many of these Stephen King, Paramount, Castle Rock type movies that I was convinced that, like, when I was an adult, this is what my house and family were going to look like.
And behave.
Yeah, like, I thought for sure that I would basically be like Tim Matheson in this movie when I was 36, and it's like, I'm not Steve at all.
It did not set you up for adulthood, is what you're saying.
No, it's just, it was a real sober reality, learning that. I mean, and my life is a lot better than his in many regards.
Oh, absolutely. I hope so.
I will say that. But I mean, just in terms of decor and things like that, I thought it would be a lot closer. One of the things I think Tim Matheson is good in the movie, but there's certain things in the performance it might be the writing more, that kind of are real head scratchers for me. Like, he loses it in class, like, right away. And he walks in with, like, a preemptive defeat.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that before, where, like, the teacher will just walk in and he's just like, I know you guys all hate me already. And I'm like, why don't you just try first? Yeah, it's like he doesn't even want that. He's just, like, well past that point. He's just like, let's just get this over with.
What about the girl with the bangs, like, the crispy bangs? Like, she's one of the ones that gets killed. Or she, what was the, you know what I'm talking about? She had, like, that super, like, mall hair that girls used to have.
Yeah.
And their bangs look like a claw on their forehead.
It made me nostalgic. I mean, like, I used to, like, it brought me back to the days of Wanna Fall in Love by Jane Child. With the pain in her nose and things like that.
She was so rebellious for her time, wasn't she?
Yeah, I was like, she has a chain in her nose? What if it gets caught in something?
And she's like, yeah, she looks like a rocker chick, and she's playing the poppiest of pop songs. I remember she had, like, the super long hair with the braids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I still listen to that song maybe once a month. I kind of like it. So.
It's a good song.
It's a good pop song. It really is. The punks, I mentioned this to you in our Facebook chat, but the punks, they go woo, like, a few too many times for my taste.
Yeah, and they just, like, the makeup that's on their faces to make them look dead-ish or zombie-ish. It's a little it's a little over the top.
They look like, have you seen Army of Darkness?
No.
It's the third Evil Dead movie, and it's like when Bruce Campbell plays like the evil, like medieval kind of main bad guy. That's like his face looks exactly like Robert Ressler as Richard Lawson. And sometimes they come back. But in that movie, it's campy. In this one, it's just like, oh, no, this is supposed to be terrifying.
Yeah, so, it's a...
But I don't know. With like all the woos and stuff, I was just like, did they just get direction, like, you know, be punks? Or like, what were they all scripted?
You know, like they did in the 50s. Just say woo a lot. That's what they used to do.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of 50s, I got a question for you because I'm wondering if this is clearer in the book. There's no reaction by any of the other students that 50s greasers are in their class.
No. And actually, this is what's really good about the story. The other kids are freaked the fuck out by these guys. They get it. Like, they are an anomaly. They are not of their time. And these guys look like they don't give a fuck. Like, they are very menacing. And everybody feels it. And the room, like, the room just gets scared. The kids get more and more scared, too. Like, everyone gets it that these guys are just beyond, you know, from another time. I mean, they're bad dudes. And the kids start dying. Like, you know what I mean? So, like, it happens within a couple of months of each other. So, no, that's part of what makes it so scary is, like, everyone can kind of tell, but nobody knows what to do.
Yeah, that's one thing I couldn't, like, wrap my head around in the movie, at least. It's just, like, what is everybody else's interpretation of this reality? Because there's certain things where, like, when the first student, the kind of, like, Lost Boys kid, like, takes the header off the bridge with his bike, he is being chased by the car, but the car is only visible to Tim Matheson.
Right, and
but
has
then, like,
the fire
later
on
in the
it.
Movie, yeah, but then, like, it's weird because you would think that the greasers would be invisible and not just the car, but they're, it's so, like, the logic of it all, and I mean, obviously, it's a fantastic story, so, like, it could be illogical, but within the context of its own rules, I wasn't sure, like, who could see what.
The kids can see it, and actually, I forgot to mention that there's one character, his name is Chris, and he kind of becomes friends with the greasers, and he hangs out with them. And he's actually, like, the lead troublemaker. He's, like, the one, like, big pain in the ass when he first takes on the classroom. And then these guys come in, and then one day he meets with the teacher, with Jim, after school, and says, "Hey, can I talk to you about something?" He's like, "Oh shit, what's up with you?" And he says, "Look, I got to tell you something. I've been hanging out with these guys and having beers with them and stuff. They scare the shit out of me, and they've got a real they basically like they got like a hard on for you. Like they're coming to get you. I'm really worried about you." And Jim's like, "Okay, thanks, man." And then Chris just disappears. And then he goes by Chris's house and asks his father, like, "Hey, what happened to Chris?" And the father is like an absentee father and just says, "Oh, I don't know, man. He packed up his van. He says he's going to go to California and be a hippie." This is 1974. So did he disappear to be a hippie or did they do something to him? You don't know. But that's a good question. Like, the other students in that class in Living with Lit, they get it. They get, and they're, because at first they're kind of laughing at these guys because they have the leather jacket. They look like Fonzie, and it looks weird to them. But they get pretty soon like, oh no, these are really fucked up people.
Okay. Yeah, so this, you said his name was Chris in the book. This is the Chip character in the movie then, it sounds like.
Yeah, the Chip character. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I always thought it was funny because, like, Chip was supposed to be, like, the dumb jock in the movie, but it obviously, like, you know, not all football players are super athletic, especially at the high school stage.
Right.
But this Chip guy, like, there's a couple of shots of him, like, running, and I'm just like, that ain't going to work.
Bless his heart. Chad.
Yeah, poor
Ted,
Chip.
Poor Pat Yurgas? Dyergas? Anyway.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, I'm just looking at his name. It's Chad with two D's. Nyergas. Yeah.
Nyergas.
Yep.
Yes.
Oh, it's a fun performance, but yeah, it's I'm noticing from just Stephen King adaptations on film, he has like a real consistent through line with his depiction of high school classes. He seems to like have had a lot of problems with
that. Yeah. He taught high school.
Yeah.
And he did it for many years. So, like, yeah, he based the character of Carrie on a couple of different girls that he taught or were in basically in the high school that he taught. So, yeah, he's seen a lot of shit in like late 60s, early 70s. So I'm sure it was crazy then. I mean, there were hardly any rules.
For sure. Yeah. So this was interesting. I mean, like, I'm glad that you wanted to talk about this one because this was the first time that I had seen this movie. There's a lot of like the TV adaptations that I didn't really get around to until probably The Stand. And I think I started watching most of them after that.
Right.
But this was good to seek out.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had fun with it. I had fun talking with you.
It definitely has that vibe of, I said this with, I was talking to Patrick Bromley about this when I saw The Dead Zone for the first time. And there's something about Stephen King adaptations, most specifically like the ones made by Paramount, that just feel like you're being wrapped in like a warm Afghan blanket and you're putting like a fireplace. You're like, you know, putting a fire on in the fireplace and everything like that. There's just something very cozy about them.
When did you see The Dead Zone for the first time?
Maybe it was either last year or 2 years ago.
It's one of my favorites.
I think it was 2 years ago because I remember it was before the 2016 election.
Before everything went to hell.
Yeah. Who knew?
That's one of my favorites, by the way. And I think Brooke Adams is really good in that movie.
Yeah, she's really, really solid. I know she's in the Invasion of the Body Snatchers 78, and I haven't seen that one. But she's impressed me in everything that I've seen her in. She's a good actress. She's very good at just kind of like bringing a lot of humanity and kind of life to a character that could easily be like thinly written.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I got a real random question for you. This goes back to the ending of Sometimes they Come Back.
Sure.
All right. I make this joke with friends all the time. Whenever I see a movie where it's like something fantastic happening, like an example is in Poltergeist, like when the closet is like sucking, is threatening to suck like the little girl into a portal into another dimension, or like they're in the movie Gravity where Sandra Bullock is stranded in space or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I had that with this movie too, with when Wayne says to Jim, he's just like, you know, come to heaven with me. I would be like, yeah, all right. And it's not like I want it to be over. It's more like, that sounds like an offer I'll never get again.
Yes.
And it beats going to work tomorrow.
Well, you would like to be asked nicely and have a nice transition with it, right? You wouldn't want it to be like a big shock. Like in most movies, when you're in, people go to heaven, it's just like, bam, they're dead. And they're like, Jesus, what's going on? Where am I? Like, it would kind of be nice to have like a transition person kind of like, hey, what's up? You want to come with me?
It would be cool. Yeah. And also, like, I feel like Wayne would have been understanding enough where if Jim said, hey, can I have like a 5-minute powwow with my family?
Yes.
And then he's just like, he's like, hey, guys, why don't we just try it out?
But he's just bringing him, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, what if it could have been like a literal 7 minutes in heaven?
Well, heaven is a place on earth.
Oh, that's a good song, too. Is that Belinda Carlisle?
Belinda Carlisle. And I saw her 3 years ago in Coney Island. And she opened up for the B-52s. And here's the funny thing. She and her backup singer showed up, but the band's equipment got lost in flight cross country. So she had to sing along to like a backup track. And that's when I realized she doesn't sing very much at all, if at all. She's cute as a button, but
yeah,
it got a little like, you know, I'm mad about you. And she just kind of claps her hand and goes side to side. You're like, oh boy, she needs a lot of backup.
The B-52s wouldn't loan her their gear?
No, the B-52s had their own shit. And they were amazing. Okay. They were amazing.
That sounds amazing.
It was a great double bill. Yeah, but it was right by, and it was right by the water and everything. It was great.
That's great. Yeah. I needed to go back to learn how great the B-52s were, because my first introduction to them was like Love Shack and Rome, which were fine. But then I remember that my judgment got cloudy with the whole BC-52s from the Flintstones thing.
Oh, yeah, that's and not good.
And I mean, hey, everybody's got to eat, you know, I get it. But, like, you need to, like, go back, and then you're just like, wow, there are some real gems, like, in those early days.
So you got to go into YouTube and look up Rock Lobster. And in 1970s, there's a black and white version from their club days in Athens. And somebody got those like cheap early, you know, video cameras, and it's just him basically singing, and you can see the band, and it's fucking phenomenal. Like they just sound like Led Zeppelin. Like they're so good.
That's great.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that.
I'm digging them. Yeah,
I'll send that to you.
I like Private Idaho.
Is yes,
amazing. Oh, good stuff.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Where can everybody find you on social media, if you want them to find you?
You're asking me on a day where I do want people to find me. I write every week and sometimes do podcasts on fthismovie.net. And you can find me on Twitter at Risky Adam, and that's R-I-S-K-E, Adam. So you can find me there, and it would be great to hear from you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thank you so much for listening to the Book Versus Movie podcast. We are a part of the Electronic Media Collective. We follow the hashtags Pattern Family and Lady Pod Squad, and we record all of our shows on the Zoom Handy H4N, donated to us by our friend Nick at the Dependent Independent Podcast. Yeah.
organization.